Hello, my name is Jen Hickey. Welcome to the WEN podcast, a series of conversations with people as they share their WEN moments. Recognizing these times can change our destiny, help us to stop hiding behind the past or clinging to a future that may or may not happen. This podcast is about recognizing the power of the WEN moments. Hi, so here we are at episode 6 already. I just want to thank you again for the overwhelming support and feedback that you've given me so far. I'm delighted to say that last week's podcast about nutrition seems to have struck a chord. So please keep that feedback coming and remember to like and subscribe to the WEN podcast. So this week, I'm chatting to global endurance athlete Jason Black.
You know, I'm sitting eating my breakfast at 8:15 in the morning to get the 8:30 bus. You know, and I'm choking on the vomit on the back of my throat. And the hair is standing on my neck, you know, knowing that when I go through the gates at 9:15, it's going to start again.
Jason describes climbing Mount Everest like he was climbing out of the gutter of life. He tells us of his brave, powerful story of how he was bullied every day for 6 long years in secondary school, the pain that followed, and how now, looking back, how he would do things differently. This is for every parent that worries about their child in school or anyone in any environment where bullies exist. I start by asking him to take me back to life just before he started secondary school. I really hope you enjoyed this episode as much as I did and feel inspired to live life to the fullest every day. There are lessons in here for everyone. Enjoy.
Then I suppose, you know, we outgrow primary school and I was ready for the next adventure in my life, which was to head off to secondary school. And secondary school was based in Letterkenny. It was in the middle of the town. And for me, coming from the rural part of Donegal, I'd never been on a bus before. I'd never been on a school bus before. I'd never had a school uniform before. And it was exciting. My mum took me into town and we went to the tailors and we got our new uniform and got our new books. And I remember me, myself and mum, we'd be there on the kitchen table putting the cellophane on the back of the books to make sure they'd last the 365 days of an enduring school year. And I remember my first day going to school. It was amazing going to secondary school and I was so up for it. I had outgrown national school. I was ready for the next journey in life. And sadly for me, that's where the wheels really come off. Off my bus of life. And I remember walking through the gates and quite quickly, within a matter of days, I fell victim to an extremely violent bully at secondary school. In reflection, I don't think it was anything other than just I was in the wrong place at the wrong time. I think I was probably a little bit green behind the ears coming from the countryside, and he was a little bit more shrewd and streetwise. And I probably stood out like a sore thumb. And for 6 years, I actually physically and mentally went through in the most enduring torture that you could imagine.
Oh my God!
And I didn't. I suppose my biggest weakness, and it's something I speak a lot about today in schools and in talks with kids that I do throughout the country and throughout the world, is to have the courage to speak up and speak out and seek help. But in reflection, when I look back at that time in the 80s and 90s in Ireland, we were a country that the openness of speaking out about whether you were gay, whether you were being bullied, whether you were struggling in life with sexuality, religion, or any matter of fact, it there was no door and there was no society with a voice or an ear to listen.
Yeah. And Jason, so I have this image of you because actually my own son, who's 13, my third, has just started now his journey in secondary school. And I, you know, it's every parent's, you've 4 kids yourself, I'm sure for you watching your children as well, it's every parent's worst fear that they're going to fall victim to this kind of bullying. And I just have this image of you heading off happy, excited, you're in your uniform, bag on your back and, you know, like that whole new adventure starting. And as the mum and dad at home, you're so excited for them and all that. And this happened to you literally within the first few days. And was it did you even know at the time?
No, I didn't know what bullying was, first and foremost. I had no experience the effects of it. I came from a very loving and caring community in the countryside, both at home and within my inner community. My sporting background and life within Cubs and Scouts was filled with nothing but kindness and friendship and camaraderie. And all of a sudden, this was a completely new chapter for me. I didn't even know how to handle it. I mean, I didn't have the skill set, I didn't have the intelligence, I didn't have the capability of processing what was actually happening. And I just decided to suck it up. And, you know, I could see, you know, and it, you know, you brought up a very valid point there. You know, I'm sure, and I've never spoke about this before, I'm sure my mom and dad were extremely proud of the eldest child in the house to be heading off to secondary school for the first time. And I kind of, that's probably part of the reason why I didn't speak up and speak out. I didn't want to disappoint.
Sure.
You know,
did you have any other friends in school? Like, did you know anybody else going in, or were you just heading in knowing nobody?
No, you coming from a country area, there was one or two knocking about that you kind of knew, and through your sport you knew them, but I didn't have a strong bonded relationship with any one or two particular people at that moment in time. You know, it's not to say that I wasn't a friendly guy or that I wasn't outgoing. Sure. I just was, you know, a typical 13 years of age. Yeah. You're just mucking through life yourself, and you're picking up friends as you go along, and you're developing a relationship as you go along. I definitely felt very isolated. I've thankfully I've come to terms with it, you know, and it took me a long time to deal with this. Like, it's not like, you know, you can just bullying leave scars that people can't see. These are very deep rooted scars, and they're not like a black eye or a bruised arm. These are scars that take a lifetime to remove. Whether it's in a marriage, whether it's in a work environment, or whether it's in a school environment, it has the same crippling and devastating effects. Mm-hmm. And I remember sitting eating breakfast in the morning, and this is probably one of the most vivid memories I have. You know, sitting eating, my mum would put out porridge or cornflakes or whatever was available, eggs and toast. And, you know, I'm sitting eating my breakfast at 8:15 in the morning to get the 8:30 bus. You know, and I'm choking on the vomit on the back of my throat, and the hair is standing on my neck, you know, knowing that when I go through the gates at 9:15, it's going to start again. And
oh my God, it's hard to hear, actually, you know, and obviously this happens all the time, every day, somewhere. And I know a lot of the listeners here, we're the majority of us are parents, so it's important to talk about it, and really grateful for you to do it. I mean, when you look back, do you think your parents knew something was going on? Do you think, were there signs as a mum or dad watching your kids now, looking back, what are the signs? Do you think that something is not right going on in school?
Yeah, my dad talks
the talk, you know, and full of bravado.
Yeah, and I kind of hid a lot, you know, an ironic part about it was that my dad was a black belt in jiu-jitsu, and I was a practicing martial artist guy from 6 years of age. I was introduced to martial arts as a family, like all my siblings done it because my dad was the coach, and I became a black belt myself at the age of 19 years of age, and I had this ability to be a fighter inside me. But I just never used it. I didn't have the confidence to use it. And also, I was this small, shy guy. I wasn't this big, large man that I am today. I definitely, my biggest regret, Jen, is that I never spoke up. And that's the biggest message that I carry with me today, is that bottling it up doesn't make it go away.
Why do you think you said nothing?
I think society back then wasn't an open enough society for it. Yeah. I think my dad did realize it was going on. And remember, he did say, look, Jason, is there something wrong? I said, there's a bit of bullying. And he said, I'll sort it out. And I said, no, look, Dad, I'll sort it myself. But that was near the end. And a lot of the damage was done at this stage. The confidence within the teaching fraternity wasn't strong at the time as well. I have this very clear, vivid memory of really old style dinosaur teachers that were there clocking hours and not really caring about the student. And I can thankfully report today through all the talks that I'm doing, and I'm back in the same schools that the bullies exist, and I'm facing the bullies face-to-face and the victims face-to-face. And the one wonderful supporting mechanism that's there is the young teachers that exist within Ireland and globally throughout the world. They're there, they care, and they share, and they lower themselves to the level of the student. And I always felt at school that we always needed to come up to the level of the teacher, and we didn't have the skill set to do that.
Yeah,
very different today, which is, and I have so much respect for the young teachers of today. They're teaching at a whole new level. I'm not talking education. I'm talking skill sets, manners, respect, courtesy, empathy, teaching young kids how to aspire and to dream and to believe. That's what we're experiencing today in school. And that didn't exist back then.
So, Jason, just briefly, because I know it's hard to go back. When you're talking about bullying, because I know there's lots of different types, you said earlier was it that he was actually attacking you, or was it more verbal, or was it both? Or because obviously it can take on lots of different forms.
Yeah, so it took on huge forms. Three major ones for me were the physical abuse, which was the odd dead leg, punch in the arm, those sneaky kind of stabs at you, and they were quite injuring. The other simple one was like the school bag would go missing, and it would go missing for nearly 3 or 4 hours, and I would turn up to English without my bag, and I didn't have the courage to say to the English teacher that somebody took it, or where it had gone, and I was in the firing line from the teacher, and I was getting more homework to do, I was getting lines to do, I was getting sent to the headmaster, I was getting all this abuse, which was coming from a completely different angle. So there's a second form of bullying going on, actions of the bully. And then there was the isolation, that the bully had the power to isolate individuals, me being one. And now in talking to some of the other guys in the class, they were experiencing maybe not the same violence that I was experiencing, but certainly the same victimization in relation to being isolated and treated differently. So they had massive mental effects.
Oh God, I can imagine over 6 years. It's torture. And if a parent is noticing that their child is behaving, differently, perhaps quiet, maybe a little bit withdrawn, but they're not exactly offering up because, our kids today, I suppose they're online now as well. They're faced with lots of different ways of being bullied. I mean, as a parent, how do you get involved? Do you get involved? Should you get involved? What's the boundary? I know with my two older two, when they were growing up, they would always want me to just kind of stay out of it and let them deal with it. So as a parent, what would you say to parents in terms of getting involved in something like that?
So let's examine the effects, first of all, and this will answer the question, should I or should I not? The effects are that I walked out of that school with no education.
Yeah.
I didn't have a junior cert and I didn't have a leaving cert. When I went to pick up my final leaving cert results, the headmaster, who had no idea what I'd gone through for 6 years, told me that I would never amount to anything. And I went through a very painful youthful depression, and I didn't know that it existed. My self-worth was zero. My road ahead was very dark. I couldn't see a future. And that's the individual that I was. And if that's the effects and trauma that can be left at the hands of an individual without being challenged, well, then the question that you asked is answered. For me, regardless of the consequences,
get involved,
no matter what, and take everybody out of the jigsaw puzzle if they're not playing the game.
Yeah.
I would take the legs from everybody, and I mean that sincerely, from the institution right through. And I would encourage teachers to be more visual and more aware, and they are. I would encourage parents to be checking in on a more regular basis, to be not just listening to the child or to the youth saying, "I'm fine, it's okay," because that's what I was saying. That typical man bravo about me, and chest out, "I'm fine, it's okay, it's grand, I'll deal with it." But I wasn't dealing with it, and I wasn't going away. So get involved, and at whatever level and at whatever discomfort it brings, it's worth it.
Yeah. And by the sounds of things have changed in schools. So teachers are a lot more open to it now. And certainly your headmaster sounded like a piece of work. Good Lord. So I'm just curious now, Jason, when you look back, have you met up with this person since along the way? Have you seen him since? Have you ever had a chance to say anything to him, or would you, or because, and I wonder. So obviously what you've been through is horrendous, and it's every parent's worst nightmare, every child's worst nightmare. What is going on in the bully's head? You know, there must be chaos going on in the bully's head for them to be doing it in the first place. I mean, have you had experience with, you mentioned earlier that you're now in front of the bully as well. Have you ever been able to kind of ask the question and have they answered?
Yeah, so I spent, and Mother Nature, I suppose, was the environment that allowed me to breathe and to make peace with that time in my life. And during that time, you know, I reflected a lot on not only myself, but on the bully himself. And a bully never stops being a bully. That bully still is a bully today. Does he realize he's a bully? Did he realize the magnitude of the effects that he was causing back then? I don't actually believe he did. I believe he was coming from a home that was a bully. I think he was witnessing and experiencing that daily life, and he believed that that was normal. He didn't think that this was abnormal. He thought that this was quite a normal behavior, whether it was to build friendship, whether it was to be a dominant and be an authority within the classroom. And that's the same trait that bullies have today. My experience of bullies that have come forward and spoke to me after they have heard my story and recognizing the fact that they also are bullies, but they never realized they were. And now they reach out to me privately on Facebook or Instagram and say, Jason, I've listened to your story and I'm the bully. And I didn't realize I was the bully. And it's because they have the effects of society. They have the effects of maybe an aggressive father, an aggressive coach, an aggressive life at home. And they've been brought up in an environment that they believe this is normal. And they've been victims themselves. So,
that's incredible, Jason, that you're actually hearing from the bully. So that is amazing. That is amazing.
I think it's because I'm telling a human, honest story, and I don't dress it up or dress it down or dramatize it. I just say it as it is, and I think it's important to just tell the truth and with the reality of what a human life can look like 5 years on, from being very, very happy, content, to being broken and suicidal, because I played with the fact that I wanted to live no longer, and I felt that the world was a better place without Jason Black in it.
Oh, it's heartbreaking. It's really heartbreaking. And you left school broken.
Very much so.
And how did you even begin to rebuild? Did you even feel a sense of relief walking out of the school? Or were you that broken that it was just...
Well, you know, this is kind of where it kind of feels as if it's dramatized. Things got worse because the one person that I absolutely cherished in the world was my mum, my mother, my mommy in Ireland, in Donegal, as we call her, the glue in the family, the person putting the food on the table, feeding four very hungry kids from an empty fridge at a time when there was absolutely nothing. She got cancer, breast cancer, and only lasted for 6 months. Oh, and I lost mum 3 weeks after walking out the school gates. And I was in a pretty bad place anyway. I couldn't see a way ahead. You know, I just didn't have, where other people were going to college and were getting CEO applications in and acceptances and universities and all this. I had nothing. I have this visual in my head. I've been inundated with people asking me to write a book, and I'm really struggling with that even comprehension. But I have a title in my head, From the Gutter to the Top of the World, because I was in the gutter. I was really in the gutter. It was it was a bad place. It was a tough place, I'll tell you. And
so where did you even start?
Well, yeah, look, this is where the other bully took over, which was society. Society judged me for a long number of years, and what I mean by that was that everywhere I went in life, I was judged by having no exams. I was judged by having no leaving cert. I was judged by having no experience. And every time I applied for a job or an interview, I was always put to the back of the queue. Once they seen my resume and once they see that the CV didn't have a lot of A, Bs and Cs, more E's, D's and F's, then I was put to the back of the queue. And that became very debilitating for me as a human being, at 17, 18 and 19. So thankfully for me, I was a dogged person. I had endured a lot in life, you know, with losing mum and losing Billy Billy was my brother, yeah. I lost my brother then, and when I was 25, myself and Billy were in America together. I went out to Billy for a couple of weeks, and we were on the motorbikes, and on the final day when I was due to fly home that evening, we had a crash, and Billy was killed, and I survived.
Oh my God.
He was a year younger than me, and, you know, growing up in Donegal, he's your best friend and arch enemy at the same time, because, you know, we'd done everything together. We were on bikes together. We were in the rivers together. We were in the mountains together. We fought like brothers fight. We used to spit each other's chips when we were going to the toilet in case the other person would eat the other person's chips. But we were best friends behind it all. He had my back and I had his, and that was a tough, tough one. So I got a job in Dunn Stores in Letterkenny, and I was packing the shelves, and I was always this individual that I was going to do something, I would do it to the best of my ability. I had, for whatever my mom and dad put into me, it was always that value and behavior. If you're going to do something, do it well and do it to the best of your ability. And I always carried that strength, and that's kind of my identity today. That's who Jason Black really is. So I became the best packer of shelves in Dunn Stores in Letterkenny. And I would do that like it was the best thing in the world. It became so noticeable one day to the Cadbury's rep that came in that he asked me after 2 years, Jason, would I be interested in going for a job in Coolock in Dublin? And his name was Parik Murray. And I said, Parik, God, you know, I don't know. And he said, look, jump on the bus and go to Dublin. I did, went and done the interview with a guy called Ernie Overy. And lo and behold, I got the job. And the next question was, Jason, do you have a driver's license? And I was like, what do I say? And I was like, yes, I do. And I didn't. And it's not something I'm proud of, Jen, but it's like the story goes, you get an opportunity in life. It comes along, comes knocking.
You're going to take it.
You tell a little white lie to get off your knees in life and to get up the ladder of life. Well, if that's what it takes, that lie was worth it so much.
Yeah.
And I came home and I'd done the interview. Sorry, I got the interview. They sent down a car. The ironic thing was that I'd met Sharon, my beautiful wife, who was my girlfriend. And Sharon had a full license. I had a provisional license. I photocopied the green provisional license of mine and the pink provisional license of Sharon. The fax went to Dublin, which was black and white. As far as people were concerned, they had a full license in front of them, and they sent me down a brand new Escort estate car. I was on my knees, and I was on the road to somewhere. Yeah. And I spent 6 years with Cadbury's. I became the Donegal and Ulster rep. I then got headhunted by Cuisine de France. IAWS purchased them, and then I became one of the first 10 to lead up that whole food concept in the petrol stations and the food.
Oh, yeah.
So I was the first one of the 10 in Ireland to be part of that journey, and we delivered that, myself and my 9 colleagues. I worked with them for 6 years, a further 6 years, and I became a regional manager. This is a guy, so it was now 12 years on the road. That became my university of life. That's where I believe I really grew as a human being. I didn't recognize the fact that all the skills that my mommy and daddy had taught me, which is fundamentally the most important, which was manners and respect and empathy, they were the most critical components that opened every door and every shop and created every sale. The fact that I didn't have the A, B, and C's and the degrees, I had manners and respect, which was critically more important to do business on the road.
And Jason, can I just ask, so how are you feeling at this stage mentally? Are you, like, you're obviously, you've had a few wins, so you're feeling probably a little bit better, but obviously the scars are still there. Do you think you had dealt with them at this stage?
No, I hadn't dealt with them at all, Jen. And this is the elephant in the room. Yeah. I think in life, you know, it's like a death. You know, everybody says time's a great healer. Time is not a great healer. Time just moves on.
Had you talked to anybody? Had you told Sharon even?
Yeah, I told Sharon and look, you know, like everything, you know, people didn't realize the magnitude of it. And you know, a typical man, you're not going to let your guard down. You know, you're not going to say too much. So, you know, I just said enough just to create conversation, but not enough to let people realize that the magnitude of this volcano was still erupting inside me. And that's what it felt like. This volcano was still erupting, but it hadn't come out. It was still inside me. And during this whole time, you know, the wonderful thing about this journey is that while I didn't have the qualifications as an academic, one thing that I was absolutely incredibly good at, and it's not arrogance, it's confidence, was sport. Yeah. I absolutely was brilliant at sport, and it's an academic that's overlooked in life. Sport allowed me the opportunity to grow as a human being. And, you know, I said earlier in the interview when I was introduced to Cubs and Scouts, Cubs and Scouts introduced me to Mother Nature, and Mother Nature, as I said earlier, became my tranquil, you know, playground where I could breathe, shout, scream, and vent everything that was going on. So whenever I got an opportunity to climb, the best version of Jason Black existed, and that kept growing while I was climbing all the mountains in Ireland, England, Scotland, and Wales, and as I was getting more proficient as a mountaineer. And
is this while you're still working in Cadbury's? So this is kind of in your free time? Yeah.
This is me in my free time. This is kind of who I am on the other side of the... And I treat them like two different words.
Yeah.
My sporting world is one word, and it's a very different world to this world that I live in today. And it's even like that as we speak today. When I go to Nepal or when I go to Pakistan or I go to an expedition that's maybe 3 months in an environment that's, you know, that very few in the world ever get an opportunity to go to, it is like going to a completely different world where there's no mobile phone, there's no emails, there's no social media, there's no expectations of society. You can just be yourself. And Mother Nature just gives you that freedom to express yourself like an artist. And it's so therapeutic and it's so liberating as a human being to be able to find yourself in that world. And I was lost in this world. I was like, as I said, like the square peg in the round hole. I just felt as if I couldn't fit in. Everything.
You kind of feel a little bit like you were just going through the motions of life.
Yeah, so I do a lot of reading today, and obviously when I'm in a mountain, I have a lot of time to read, and I kind of stumbled across this explanation about living a natural life and an adapted life. Mm-hmm. And I had this moment where the light bulb went on, and I went, wow, you know, in this world, I was living an adapted life. I was adapting to what society wanted me to be. Yeah. And how they wanted me to perform like a chimp, and the other world I was just natural. I was just this very natural person, and I was just, you know, my movement, my language, my thoughts, my behaviors were at their best, and the true version of me existed in that world. It's not to say that in today's world, while I'm here, I haven't come to terms and have the courage to walk in my own shoes and to be my own person. And even to not suppress, but not to allow society put me back in that box again. Not judge me. So I've learned to adapt to what society wants me to be, but I've not adapted as a human being. I've adapted into this world, but in that world, wow, that's who I really am. Mm. And I always say, Jason, you're your best when you're there. And I'm like, yeah. And she says, even when you come back, it's like therapy. It's like, who are you? You know. Yeah. it's a grounding, you know, when you're with communities of people, Jen, that have no money, are living, like literally living hour to hour, and have no idea of the richness of the world, you know, from a material aspect. They're just living off the land, and, you know, whether it's in the Rombok area in Tibet, you know, or whether I'm in Pakistan and the high villages, these people have no comprehension of the pressures of the world. Thankfully.
Well, I went once just for a week, but myself and my daughter, Bobby, who's now 21, we went for a week to Nepal, actually. And ironically, the night before we went, we watched the movie Everest had just come out, and we watched it. And I remember looking at it with her, going, "God, we're going to fly into that airport tomorrow." But it was one of the best weeks that I've ever had, actually. And everything that you're saying there, because we were actually going over with a charity to build schools, and amazing charity called Indrini. And my husband and my other son went out another time. It's an amazing charity, but we just loved it. And Bobby, actually, she had already done 3 weeks in a really poor part of India. So for her, it was just, she just loved it, because just the phones went away. You were just like you're saying there. And no, just people are so happy, and even though they have nothing. And I didn't feel sorry for them at all. I felt like, God, you know, we really just don't get it over here.
I felt sorry for us.
Exactly. Yeah.
I didn't feel sorry for them. I felt, they had nothing, but they had everything. I felt we had everything, and we had nothing. And that's how I felt. And the grounding that I got from that, from my times as an adventure athlete, were so incredible. And you know, it's not that you have to go to Nepal or Africa or anywhere like that in the world. You can find that same peace today. And it's something I speak about, is that take an hour a day, go for a walk. Instead of putting the headphones in and listening to music or a podcast, and I'm sorry, but there was a time and a place for everything, but listen to yourself. I think for a lot of people, they don't actually check in. And I know it sounds a little bit holistic, but you should check in. You should and say, look, am I okay? Am I going the right way? Am I living the life that I really want? Can I make a difference? Can I change? Can I be better? Or am I on the right road? And I think it's so important, that skill set.
And Jason, when did you jump? When did you decide, right, this is what I'm going to do now?
I think, you know, it's a great question. I think, you know, in life, there's people come along, and we all, I think personally, you know, even my story, as brutal as it is, it has a place in the world, and it has, it carries some nuggets of gold in there to please God, unlock somebody's disability in life, whatever's holding them back. And I think we all have a role to play, and never underestimate your strength to be inspirational, or a word which is more important to me, to be more empowering to people. So I met Dawson Stelfox, who was the first Irishman to climb Everest. I was in a pretty dark place, and he was doing a talk in Letterkenny. He was traveling around Ireland talking to loads of institutions and clubs and just people, the general population, about the climb. And I went along not expecting to, knowing what I was going to hear. And so I sat at the back and pretended as if I was tuned out. And he started talking about Everest. And oh my God, it was just this incredible story, where he talked about the trials, the tribulations, the battles of the logistics and the climb itself, the challenge of setting up camp, getting into base camp, dealing with the lack of oxygen, and all the parts that make up a very challenging expedition. He spoke about the first expedition in 1953 with Hillary and what that looked like, the time scale that it took. And I was just in awe of the story. And I still didn't want to kind of let my guard down, but I waited at the back of the room while everybody left the college. And these were all adults, and they all left the room. And he was giving out pamphlets of the expedition, which was showing photographs. And I went up there quite cagey and asked him to sign the pamphlet. I said, "Dawson, you know, I love the story." He probably could see by my language that I was really, really into it, you know, and he was putting on these major light bulbs in my mind. So he signed the booklet, and I took it home, and I never opened it. For a few days, it sat on the locker in my house, and I opened it one day, and it was Jason, always follow your dreams in life. And it was a very powerful thing that he wrote, because he could have just signed it, Dawson Still Fox, the first Irish man to climb Mount Everest, and it wouldn't have meant anything to me.
But sure,
that me a very powerful message that day. It's not to say that that's the day that I climbed Everest in my mind, but it certainly set me on the road to thinking outside the box and what could be. And I was honing the skill and craft anyway as a climber, more so just because for me it was just that expression of peace and tranquility away from the world. But then I wondered, could I climb it? I had just lost my brother at this stage. And, you know, I had that selfish nature inside me that, how can I tell anybody that I want to climb Mount Everest? How can I have that conversation with anybody? So I decided to tell nobody once again. Here I go on my journey of life.
And hold on. So why didn't you want to tell anyone? Did you feel like you were being selfish?
I didn't want anybody to stop me.
Okay. Okay.
I didn't want anybody to derail me. I had this very objective plan. I didn't know how I was going to get there. I didn't know how I was going to finance it. I didn't know if I was skillful enough to pull it off. So I spent 8 years training, and I used to work hard and get the opportunity to go off to Nepal, spend nearly 2 months in Nepal training, whether it was Island Peak or Amida Blanc or climbing the lower mountains. You know, I'd gone through an apprenticeship where I climbed my first 4,000, 5,000, 6,000. I mean, my mountaineering life was 25 years long. I just didn't
decide
that one morning I'm going to climb Mount Everest. This was a lifelong apprenticeship, because you know, we're seeing the effects of people deciding to take on 8,000 meter mountains today with little or no experience, and whenever the shit hits the fan, they perish on the mountain, and the mountain gets the bad press. But it's not the mountain, it's the lack of capability.
Yeah.
So I spent quite a long time out there, and in particular a lot of time in the Khumbu Valley in Nepal, and I had witnessed in Everest. I climbed up as far as Camp 2, Camp 3, and 3 years before I had actually taken on Mount Everest in 2013. And I'd seen the way that people were prostituting the people from the region. People that came in from, you know, Ireland, England, Scotland, Wales, America, China, all over the world, and had money and wanted people to carry the porters to carry their gear. They wanted the cooks to cook their food. They wanted people to babysit them. And it was quite... As a human being, it was quite horrible to witness, and I felt the effects of the bully again. Here's another bully process, and I decided that if it was going to be done, I wasn't going to climb it on that side. It wasn't going to let the commercialization of the climb infect or affect my ascent of Mount Everest. So I decided to go to the north side of Mount Everest through China. I spent a month in Tibet, which was liberating for me. It's another story. To see what the Chinese are doing to the Tibetan people is bonkers. But to see a resilience in people, and they remind you very much like the Irish. They're not going to let anybody break their culture, their beliefs, or their passion about who they are.
Yeah,
that's the way they live it. And just to live with those people was incredible. And I went up to the Rambut Monastery and spent a week in the Rambut Monastery, which is the highest monastery in Tibet. And I never spoke a single word, only, "Oh, Mani, bring me home."
Wow.
Chanted for a full week, myself and the high priest. And it was, I don't actually know if I can put it into words.
Yeah.
What it was like. It was just a surreal experience and a very growing experience.
And then, do you think at that point, so you're a week with your thoughts meditating in this place. Sounds incredible. I don't know whether I could do that. That's a long time. I like to chat.
No, you could. And I like to talk.
Your head must have been racing.
Yeah, so here's where it really opened up.
Yeah.
Again, I spoke earlier on about when we're in this world here, it's quite a busy world that we live in. And even though we have problems in life, we generally kind of move on. And whether we've lost a loved one, or whether we've experienced a troublesome or tragic past, we tend to get carried along in life with the next story, the next email, the next podcast, the next Facebook post, the next bill, the next child, the next relationship. But we never really fix the problem. And what absolutely happens on expedition on the magnitude of something like Everest or something huge, like Alaska across the Arctic in 2014 and spent 3 months there. And what happens in an environment like that is that the silence becomes deafening and your noise in your mind becomes so incredible that it breaks you as a human being. And that's what happened to me. So the 3 months on Mount Everest that it took me to climb it, I went there to climb a mountain. I didn't climb a mountain. I climbed out of the horror of life. And I was reduced on a daily basis to deal with the battle of the scars of the bully, the effects of losing mommy, the effects of why Billy died, and something that's precious to me, and I don't preach to people, but I'd lost the love for our Lord Jesus Christ. I was brought up as a practicing Catholic. I don't push Christianity or religion down people's throat. I have my own deep-rooted beliefs. But I fucking lost my love for that man because I felt he let me down as a human being. And I was able to make peace with all of that. So on a daily basis, I was in the horrors of grief. I was in the horrors of anger. And here I was fighting with myself saying, fuck, I'm here to climb a mountain. I'm not here to deal with this. I'm not here to deal with this. This is not what I'm here for. So in a way, you know, when I got to the summit of Mount Everest on the 19th of June, 2013, and for a lot of people, it's the holy grail in endurance to get to the greatest and highest place on the planet and to stand on a four-meter square block and see this goldfish bowl of the world and look in, and you knowing at that moment in time there's nobody else higher in the world than you, and all the airplanes that are flying globally around the world are all below you.
Oh my God, I can't even imagine.
You're there and you realize that you haven't climbed to the summit of Everest, you've climbed to the summit of your life, and that you've survived, and that I didn't survive Everest, I had survived life.
And how did you even feel? It must have been just...
I felt so free. The shackles were gone. I'd come to terms with the time, the precious time that Mother Nature had given me and allowed me to shout and breathe and scream and vent had brought clarity to what had gone on, had removed the blame, had healed the scars, had brought closure. I don't have anger with the bully today. I don't need to meet him. I don't need to tell him what he did. I love my mum, and here's a beautiful story about my mum. On the final night, such a fierce storm blowing between Camp 4 and Camp and the summit that I was so frightened. It was 100 kilometer an hour storm. I have it all videoed, recorded, of me being inside the tent, that I asked my mum to come with me on that final day. And I left it, I think I left about 1 o'clock in the morning. And I climbed right through the night, through a storm. And it was like watching the Harry Potter films. The storm had hands and fingers.
Jeez.
And it was this very real jet stream that was alive. And that was me breaking through. And I said to Mom, come with me. And my two hands were cold, but within seconds, my right hand became roasting warm. And I believe spiritually, and I don't think anybody will ever take this away from me, that my mum came to me that night, that day, that morning, and held my hand to the summit. And the minute I got there, my hand went very cold again. And I feel that mum just says, you're here now, you've survived, and you're okay.
I'm actually welling up listening to that. That's really special.
That was a very life-defining moment for me. The shackles were gone, and I was free, and I, the pride that I had in reflection, you know, because people ask me what was it like that day on the summit. It was all about pride, not for me. Yes, I was proud of me. And I think it's something as Irish people or as human beings we should be a little bit more vocal about that, because if you can't be proud of yourself, how can you be proud of anybody else? But yeah. Pride that I had in my community, the pride that I had in my mum and dad, the pride that I had in my granny and granda, and the values that they instilled in me. And while I'd lost a certain skill set to the hands of the body through an education that was lost. I had gained so much more through the university of life. I had held on the most critical values and behaviors of manners, respect, courtesy, and empathy, being able to speak to people, being able to listen to people.
Do you ever look back and kind of wonder, well, not wonder, but I mean, it sounds like the emotional trauma that you went through as a child, those 6 years in school, it was almost like you were emotionally training for what climbing that mountain in terms of like what you had to go through in school and then what you had to go through to get up that mountain. You come out, I mean, and then obviously you've got to come back down again, which is a whole other story in itself. Do you feel like that? Do you feel like that maybe that your training actually started, sorry, emotionally? I know you physically had to be training for years and years, but for you to actually, your headspace.
Yeah, so I often say to people who are struggling today with the scars of life, don't let the scars define you, or don't let the reason the scars exist define you. It's the way that you turn the negative to positive and you take the strength from it. That's what really defines you as a human being. Mm. So I work a lot today with people that are disabled and people that are struggling through life, who I have so much respect for, because you must remember, I only had to climb my Everest for 3 months. I have so much respect for people that have to climb Everest every single day of life, that are dealing with mental health, suicidal thoughts, disability, and they're every time they open their eyes every morning, they're climbing a bigger mountain than I'm ever going to climb. But it's how we climb a mountain that defines us. So sometimes the baggage that we pick up along the way in life, if you allow it, makes you stronger. Yep. If you allow it, it can break you also.
Mm.
I think, you know, often people say life is about choices, and it is, and it really is about choices. And I was faced with two choices. And I'm glad I picked the choice to stay here and not to go onto the rope. I'm glad I chose to use the weakness of the bully and the strength that he gave me to accomplish what I accomplished today, which is not the challenges that I set and not the list that you read out at the start.
Sure.
Surely it's the challenge of being able to stand in the classroom today and have the courage to speak openly and honestly about the effects of it, and to empower people today to set goals and to encourage people to set goals that are high, difficult, to instill in them that they're not going to be achievable easy, that you've got to work hard, like climbing Mount Everest, to running a marathon, or racing across a desert, or racing Eco Challenge last year. These things are not easy, but they are possible. And with hard work, dedication, commitment, and help from others.
Because yes, you climbed the mountain, but I know you were talking earlier, you had a huge team of people with you. We just have to get into this now as well, because it's I just find it fascinating. Like, what do you even eat climbing a mountain? Where do you even begin? I mean, where do you begin?
I'll take a step back. First of all, when I climbed Everest, I climbed it solo.
Did you?
Because I had this real inner belief.
I was
climbing through life alone.
I can't actually. Sorry, I'm completely shocked. On your own, your Sharon must have been distraught.
Yeah, so I started out with a climbing Sherpa called Nima Gumbu, and he got into difficulty. He had to stop early, so I was climbing on my own. Another guy that you team up with people on the mountain, because we've got a very like-minded culture there. And you must remember, on the north side of Mount Everest, it's not like what you see on the south side. There's not this big line of people to the summit. There's not any of that. Like, there's only, whenever I climbed it in 2013, there was only 24 people over there. And like, if you put 24 people on the side of Mount Everest, you don't see them. They're just scattered. But we know that we're there together. And that's what it's like. So you're there, and you really got to believe in yourself. You've got to really believe that you can pull this thing off. You've got to really believe that if things go wrong, that you can get out of trouble. And that's that's how I wanted to climb. Because for me, Jan, that's how I was. That's how I went through life. I was a very resilient person. The bully taught me this. The challenge of losing mum and bully had built me this way. I was a very unconsciously, the question you asked, I became this very resilient person.
Mm. Were you scared? Were you scared at all on that mountain?
Of course I was. Yeah, of course. I was totally scared, like shitting myself. But you've got to believe that you've got to believe that you can pull this thing off. You've got to believe that you can push past the toughness. And I had this real mental thing, and it's something I shared today with people, is that, you know, when you're climbing a mountain like Mount Everest or K2 or any of these great mountains that I get the privilege to climb and humbled to survive, you never see the summit, but you've got to believe that it's up there. And with that vision that if you keep pushing step by step, and you don't have to go at a breath-staking pace, just with purpose.
Yeah.
And if you move through life with purpose, you don't have to go through it at 100 miles an hour, but just with purpose, with firm and firm steps every day, that while you can't see where you're getting to, like I couldn't see the summit, I knew that it was there. I knew that it was up there, and through time I would get there. And I really encourage people when they're setting goals in life, and I believe we set goals, and we should write them down, because it's easy through the lips and it's harder through the pencil's tips. And what I mean by that is when you write your goal down, it's a contract between you and the goal. And it became a very important tool for me in being successful in life, on personal success. Whenever I wrote my goals down, I formed a contract between me and my goal. And I think it's a bit like New Year's Eve, whenever we say we're going to go off the cigarettes or we're going to take off exercise. And 3 days later, we just give up. It's easy through the lips, and it's harder whenever you write it down and it's meaningful. But just have the courage to just keep moving forward, but don't stop. Slow. Mm. Never turn around, but never stop. And this is probably something that still drives me today, is silence dream stealers in life. There's always people out there that have told me and still tell me to this day, I'm not good enough, strong enough, and fit enough to achieve what I achieve. And my motivation is to silence those dream stealers. So if there's dream stealers to any listener today, silence the dream stealers, find a way, use the dream stealer to be the catalyst, to give you strength, to give you the energy, to give you the commitment to push past and to be incredible, whatever incredible looks like for you.
Mm. And I think I did a podcast a few weeks back or a few months back now with Stephen Klusky, and he was in an accident when he was 18. He's paralyzed now from the neck down, but he's an incredibly inspirational guy. And he's the same message for him. It's just, it's about a purpose. He hasn't had a day of feeling sad since the accident. And I just find it incredible. I think being able to change the conversation that you have in your head, if you can understand that you can change that voice and that you can give you, as you were saying, you know, push yourself to go on, keep going, like you must have done that mountain. I can't even imagine how do you even sleep up there? I'm sorry, I'm still with the eating and the sleeping and the, you have to tell us.
Yeah,
you snuggle up with your sleeping bag and an old hot water bottle that you've, you know, boiled with the kettle. Not
well, the hot water bottle became my pee, so I used to pee into the Nalgene bottle at night, and The hot pee that came out of my body.
The hot water. Gave you momentary feeling of warmth.
That was it. And that's how we survive up there. We use everything that's available to us to survive a great big mountain like Everest.
But surely you're needing, like, I can't even imagine the amount you should be eating climbing a mountain. How do you even bring the food up?
No, I took up, I had a friend in the Irish Army that got access to the Special Forces food. It's funny, I went on the Irish Ranger course, and here I was eating their food in 2013. But I survived on that. I when I set up base camp, so how a mountain works is generally is we go into a base camp, and there's no such thing as like a base camp. It's just this big space, and you decide to pitch your tent there, and you bring your food in, and in our case, we got the assistance of
So any 8,000 meter mountain is not about any individual that can climb it on their own. It certainly needs the help of others, but like life.
So to climb K2 or Everest or any big 8,000 meter mountain, I'll give you an example on K2. So when we climbed K2, there was 8 mountaineers that went in to climb it. It took us 18 days, 9 hours a day to get to base camp from near civilization. And it required us to, there's a small village there called Skardu. So it required us to literally hire all the support from that small village, which they were very thankful for. And 110 people helped 8 climbers carry all the food and provisions that are required for us to survive for 3 months in K2. So I'll give you an example on some live product we brought up. So we brought up 45 hens, we brought up 2 cows, we brought up 1 buffalo, we brought up 4 goats, and we killed them as we needed them.
Holy cow.
Literally. And
oh, God. Was that hard? Was that hard to...
Yeah, it was very difficult. Yeah. We again, because we were in the Baltiro Glacier and we're constantly trying to give something back to the community there, we were able to get a small group of villagers to stay with us in base camp for the 3 months, which they were happy to do. And we fed them and paid them, and they set up a base camp environment for us and cooked for us. Because what people don't recognize is whenever you're climbing an 8,000 meter mountain, it's so punishing on the body with the lack of oxygen and the challenge of actually being up on a high mountain. When you return back to base camp, the last thing you want to do is start cooking and preparing food. And the only reason we come back to base after every rotation on a big mountain, and a rotation basically is like climbing up for 2 or 3 days, setting up the next camp, coming back down again, and back to base camp, and then hydrate, fuel, recover, get the body normalized again before we push up again. And when we come back, we really need good quality product. So these 4 young guys that were from the Baltiro Glacier, they prepared our food, cooked our food and everything for us. And these guys were incredible. Like, I mean, I have to give so much credit to people that support mountaineers. We get all the credit of accomplishing what we do, but there's so many other people that play such a vital role in the success of it. These guys were making like croissants, like from flour and water and on the edge of a mountain, and they were able to light a fire and use the coals and then like dig a pit in the glacier and put the product into it and surround it with coals. And we would have perfectly good croissants maybe once every 2 weeks.
Holy cow.
Oh, it was incredible. And they're just the most precious people.
And I bet it was the nicest food that you ever had. You must have been just starving with all that.
Yeah, because like you probably burn in an excess. Like any one good push on a day on K2 or Everest, you're burning well in excess of 8,000 or 9,000 calories minimum on a mountain like that. You can't keep up with the calorie deficit. There's no way you can keep up. So you're losing loads of not initially fat, but then it moves into muscle. So the body then starts cannibalizing itself. So really your lean muscle just literally disintegrates off your body. And you can even still see on my face where I still haven't recovered some. You do lose a lot through time. I come back and you're just like a skeleton.
And what goes on? So obviously, I have no idea, obviously, because I never climbed a mountain.
Yeah.
But watch the movie. Did you see the movie? Is it accurate the way they portray it? Because watching that movie, yeah, I was going, this is horrific. Like the cold and the oxygen deprivation, and they're all losing their minds.
Yeah. So yeah, that's very real. The way they captured that video or the film was absolutely very, very close to it. So the storm that they created, you know, whenever you seen them up at camp 4, whenever they were getting into trouble, and they showed the storm coming up the mountain from below,
terrifying.
That was that kind of like Harry Potter storm that I talked about, that had tentacles and hands and fingers. That's it coming at you. The lack of oxygen is so debilitating, but you learn how to handle it. And this is what happens with mountaineers that have never been, so you know, have never been in that position before. Whenever you reduce the amount of oxygen, because we're sitting out in this podcast and we've got 100% oxygen, we don't have to think about the oxygen that's in the air. We just breathe and we get on with it. Our bodies are built and designed to be at this level. They're not built and designed to be up there. I mean, I recorded something as low as 18% oxygen in blood saturation up near the top.
Crikey. So
Anything down at 90% is your own life support machine in Letterkenny General Hospital here. So, but your body,
how does that feel? Can you like?
That's why. Like, if you could just go in with have no disability, with climb Everest in a week, but because of the restrictions on oxygen and the adaptations that the body needs to make, that's why it takes us 3 months. Because
you're going up and coming down and all of that.
We climb high, we sleep low, we're letting the body adjust, we're letting the body... but whenever we do push a little bit harder than we want to, it's like the experience is like if anybody's ever fallen off a wall or if anybody's ever been winded playing football or had an experience where the wind's been knocked out of you and you're on your side and you're literally trying to suck whatever air is available, that's what it's like to climb with that oxygen.
So and you're doing that for hours.
Days. This is going on for days and days and days and days.
So what happens then? They call it the death zone at the top.
Yep.
Because your body is literally dying, I'm assuming.
Yeah, so we pass 8,000 meters and on Everest it's got a big strong striking yellow band in the rock structure. So you can physically see the line you talk about. You'll definitely feel it. When you pass 8,000 meters, nothing's functioning. Your body's pretty much in free fall. It happened to me about seven and a half, where my digestive system had shut down. The oxygen that's available, or the little oxygen that's available, the body's making a conscious decision just to supply the vital organs, heart, lungs, pulmonary and cardiac system, and all the other systems are literally just getting piecemeal. You know that the fuel that you're consuming isn't actually contributing to any positive energy process, so it's the body's really relying on its aerobic ability to chew the muscle, chew the fats, whatever's left on the body. And you're also on a ticking time bomb, because once we enter the 8,000 meter mark, the body is dying, and practically that's what's happening in its physiological capacity. So you're then wanting to push from the death zone straight through to the summit and back down and get out of there as quick as possible. And you don't want to spend any longer than 24 hours in there. So, and it roughly takes you about 24 hours. The windows are about 24 hours to climb from 8,000 meters to the summit and back down again. All things equal, with nice weather or reasonable weather, that's what it looks like.
Jeez.
But it's, you know, we paint this horrifying picture, but it's precious too.
Oh, I can imagine.
It really is. And it's because, Jen, you know, you allow the body to adjust. So as challenging as it is, you've made peace with the environment, you've made peace with the difficulty and the challenge, and your body has adapted, and now you're going through the motion. And it's like probably running the last, you know, 4 or 5 kilometers of a marathon. You're just in that state of, that's about what it's like when you start out at the climb at the bottom. It's like running your first 5K in a marathon, and then the middle section is difficult, the last section is brutal, and the final piece where you just see the finish line is balls out. That's what it's like. And that's what
and
it's
the
like.
Endorphins are, well, gosh, are there any endorphins left at that stage?
Yeah. So for me, I was pretty good at the top. You know, when I got to the summit on both climbs, those two big ones, I was able to remove the mask. I had this mad story on Everest where I got there at 7 o'clock in the morning and I was on my own and there's nobody else with me. And I have five brilliant friends at home who are friends for all my life, and we knock the life at each other all the time. And I had this mad thing in my head: who's going to take my photograph? If I don't have of me on the summit of Mount Everest, these bollocks aren't going to believe that I actually. So on the 19th of May 2013, it was Red Nose Day in Britain, and the British team come up from the south side. And they had this big troop with them. I could see them coming on the southeast ridge on the way up. So I waited on the summit, and they arrived up, and they were doing a live broadcast on BBC News just below my feet. And they actually are the people that took my photograph. So if anybody jumps on to 19th of May 2013 Red Nose Day and BBC, they'll see this mad Irishman sitting on the summit, and that's yours truly.
Amazing. And is like, really stupid question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. The cold, Jason. I'm trying to, you know, get into the sea at the moment for like 10 seconds and it's killing me. I can't even imagine the cold.
Yeah, the cold, it's cold, like, again, but the body adjusts. You know, once you start, I think it's because we become so accustomed to heat in a home, in a house, and then when we go outside, we get that chill feel, and all it is our body hasn't adjusted. So whenever you're a part of acclimatization on the mountain is also cold acclimatization. So when you're in base camp and you're sleeping in your tent or you're going about your business, because you're generally during the day getting ready, getting kit together. So you're out and about all day long on a glacier. You're on a live, active glacier, which is a moving river of ice below you. And it's freezing. It's like minus 20 degrees most of the time. And it's bitterly cold, but your body adjusts. It's absolutely incredible how you become quite accustomed to the cold. But there's no preparation for minus 30 degrees wind chill up top, where you're absolutely just cold, tired, lethargic, and just you're in that zone where it's down to this capacity as a person of all the skill sets, all the skill that you brought from the bully, all the learning that you brought from the deaths, all the endurance that you've gone through in training and preparation, self-belief, commitment from coaches, the apprenticeship of ice climbing and all the craft that you've learned. Now you're going to bring it all to this one perfect moment in this perfect storm, and you're going to break through in this and the defining moment on this magical journey in life. And that's what it felt like to me. It was like, it was all this, everything rolled in together, the good, the bad, and the ugly had all become part of the toolbox of success. And when we spoke earlier on about what's, you know, that we must kind of use the tools as uncomfortable as they are of a miserable past or of a breakup or of a previous experience which was not very pleasant, we've got to add that into the good, because it's only when you put that together and you make this incredible snowball, then it's solid, and then you've got something very resilient to work with. So
well, it is incredible, Jason, and I know you're very humble, and I know you don't like to say about climbing the mountains and all of that, but you know, it is amazing that you've used what you've gone through to do this. And you know, for anyone listening that, or you know, a teenager or something like that, that can get that from that, to know that, you know, it, whatever you're going through now, it's a moment in time. Use it, and you know, I think it's amazing what you've done. Absolutely incredible. Well, you're so brave.
Well, I suppose the way I'd like to leave it in people's minds is that I'm even though I've done what I've done, that's me, and that is me.
Sure.
But we all should celebrate each other's successes on the same level. There's nobody better or worse in life. I don't sit here to pretend that I'm any better than anybody else. I don't beat my chest any harder than anybody else. Mm-hmm. I'm proud of who I am, what I am, and what I've achieved. I'm proud of what I've had to come through to get to where I've got to. And what I say to people is, have the courage to find out who you really are in this incredible life. And we've heard our parents and our grandparents telling us down through the years that this is a very short journey and we're only here for a short time. And I suppose for me, while I'm here, I'm going to make the best of it. Even though I've had to deal with some tragedy, whatever's left, I'm going to absolutely live it to the best. But what I really want to do is I want to help other people along the way. And I suppose this journey has afforded me the wisdom today that the greatest gift that we have, or the greatest success that we'll ever achieve, is to help somebody else less fortunate. Mm-hmm. For me, if there's nuggets and gold in my story, or if there's a hand that I can reach out to somebody that's possibly on their knees in Dunn's Doors, like the example that I made, which was me and my hands and knife are in the gutter, well then, this is the hand of fellowship. And we should all reach out, and because we don't know the day, the hour, or the moment where it could be us.
100%. And I could literally sit here and talk to you all night. So I'm going to ask you, if there's a parent listening, or even a teenager, but let's say a parent, what should the parent say to the child? And I know we spoke earlier and you're saying that definitely intervene. So that's fine. But as parents, we tend to say the wrong thing, do the wrong thing, and we end up making a shambles of it sometimes. What do you say to teenagers, or what should a parent say to a teenager that could be going through this right now, but they're terrified of you even going in saying it to the school? Or where do you start?
Well, you know, my first message tonight, today, is to the victim. If you're listening, whether you're a student, whether you're a youth, whether you're a husband or a wife in a relationship that's broken, whether you're in employment that's you're struggling and unfortunately you have to be there due to financial stresses that are going on in your life, you don't need to put up with this. There's no room for it in society, and it's not you. The bully's not picking on you because of who you are. It's to do with the set of circumstances based around the bully. Please seek help. Reach up, reach out, and ask for help. To parents, and if you don't have the courage to do it, if you don't have the courage to do it and you're a friend of somebody that knows that somebody's been bullied, have the courage to do it for that person. Have the courage to, even though the circumstances around it could be quite harrowing, in other words, you could be in for a bit of bullying yourself, have the courage to be strong enough to speak up for that person. If you don't and you choose to keep that to yourself and you know that the bullying's gone on, well, then you may as well join the queue because you're enabling the bully. Yeah. And as hard as that might sound, that's the truth. To parents, all I'll ever say to parents is, keep checking in. You know, ask the tough questions. You know, look, I know it's difficult for parents. I'm a parent of four myself. But build relationships. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not that you ever get in close and you realize absolutely everything that's happening in their life, because there's parts of the jigsaw puzzle that we'll never know what's happening in their life. But having clean, open, clear dialogue, a trust relationship, friendly relationship, and trying to spot, is there anything that's giving me some clue as to what's going on? What I would say to parents is, please don't live in the clouds. Don't think it's not happening. If you think it's not happening, you are such a fool. For me, my bully stopped at 4 o'clock in the evening. The bullies today are existing 24/7 online. They're trolling the internet. They are soul-destroying, and they can suck the life out of your children. That's not to say that it's happening across the board, but it does exist.
Yeah, yeah, of course.
It's to find out at what level it exists in your life. And again, as parents, you know, if you know that it's going on and your kid doesn't have the courage to deal with it or doesn't want the embarrassment of their parent having to go in and to intervene, knock it in the head. Go straight in and get it done, no matter what the consequences. Because the kid or the youth mightn't see it today, but they'll thank you tomorrow.
Yeah, yeah. Jason, thank you so much. I appreciate your time. Your story is incredible. As I said, I think what you're doing is amazing. I can't wait to see what you're going to do next. Have you anything lined up? I know COVID's probably put a dampener on some plans.
Well, I'm off to, something that's near and dear to me is, I work with the Irish Red Cross from a humanitarian point of view. I'm a global ambassador for them, but more importantly, I work very closely on the ground, and I'm off to do a race now in Rwanda, Uganda, and Burundi. So I'm keen to get over there. I'm going to the Congo jungle to work with some kids in there that have been displaced due to the civil war that's happened in there about 10 years ago. So I work with kids over there. So I'm going over there in the 26th of January. I have, that's quite passionate to me. So I'm taking the opportunity to race in Africa, but I'm also using it as a humanitarian journey for me as well. And also it's great because, do you know what's very special, Jen? A kid anywhere in the world is always a kid. And when you stand in a classroom in Africa and you tell the same story that I've told tonight to them, it has the same impact. And it's just beautiful to sit in a classroom with kids and whether it's in Africa, Rwanda, whether it's in Oman last year or anywhere in the world, Fiji last year, it's just so special. And to be honest, it's the greatest summit that I'm standing on today. It's the greatest mountain that I'm climbing today. It's the greatest finish line that I'm getting there today. And it's the greatest medal that I'm hanging around my neck, is having the courage to stand in a classroom and just be honest and open about your journey in life. And it's because you're not reading it out of a book, and it's because it happened to you. I believe it's making an impact.
Oh, it absolutely is making an impact. God, it's incredible. And the Congo, that's wow.
So there's loads, and I have a couple of races. I'm going to have to do a race across America on the 16th of June. So 5,000 kilometers nonstop from Oceanside, California to Boston. So I'm really excited about that.
Jeez. Do you ever get a bit tired, Jason?
No, look, you know, it's
I'm exhausted thinking about it.
What's great about it is, and what's been very uplifting is that a lot of people come with me on my adventure and share the experience. And I think they get to see the honesty when you're broken as a human being.
Yeah.
And during those type of races or during those type of climbs, you get really broken as a person. You don't live this kind of, I'm strong all the time. You show your vulnerability. You show your vulnerability. And I think when you show your vulnerability, you show your heart to people. And then when you can show that, even though it's absolutely brutally tough just to hear it now, there's a brighter day tomorrow, and then I keep pushing through it. And a lot of people are taking strength from my actions and not my words. And I think actions are speaking louder than words today more than ever. And I think that 2021 is a really important year. I think everybody's seeking not inspiration but empowerment, just to get back on the wagon, to set goals again, to not let the pandemic extinguish whatever future could and should lie ahead, that we should dream bigger and work harder and find solutions to obstacles. Because, you know, even though I'm with the best will in the world, you plan your expedition, your race or whatever, there's always something, Jen, that's going to happen along that journey that's going to throw a curveball, and you're going to have to organically be able to adjust and overcome. And life's exactly the same. And that's why the pandemic at the minute is...
Yeah.
It's the greatest opportunity for people to redirect themselves.
Couldn't agree more. And, you know, I wouldn't be doing this podcast without the pandemic. So on one level, whilst it's driving me nuts not being able to go out as much, I suppose, but it really got me to change my own course and kind of think about things. So I couldn't agree more with you. I think it's absolutely, the world is telling us this is what we need to do for sure.